For many centuries, the book of Esther has caused a great deal of heartburn in the church. And that's because God is never mentioned one time in this entire drama. Martin Luther, the reformer, didn't like the book of Esther at all. As a matter of fact, he said it included, and I quote, "too many heathen unnaturalities." And it does, by the way. John Calvin, the reformer, never preached a sermon from the book of Esther, nor did he include it in his commentaries. In fact, for the first 700 years of church history, not one commentary was produced on the book of Esther. The Jewish people, on the other hand, revered the book, as you can well understand and imagine. Moses Maimonides, a famous 12th century doctor and teacher, considered it equal with the books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, in spite of the fact that neither Esther nor Mordecai will mention the law, the Torah, the books of Moses, even the covenant of God to the people of Israel. And in fact, they won't even mention the name of God. Jewish scholars have tried to remedy this problem centuries ago in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. They composed 107 verses in all and added it to the book of Esther. It included prayers from Mordecai and prayers from Esther, the kind of thing that you'd like to hear. Surely they prayed it, so let's add it. They tried to make it a little more acceptable, you know, to kind of clean it up. These 107 verses were obviously late additions to Scripture, and although the Catholic Church endorsed it in their Apocrypha in the 16th century, Protestant scholars chose to accept the book as it was first penned, most believe, by Ezra and his associates. The rough edges were left intact, and there are rough edges. The heathen unnaturalities, however, if we take them at face value, they add to the crisis. The missing prayers only add to what God obviously wants us to understand, that He is faithful even when His people are unfaithful. But we don't need to try to clean up the people. Although this book is never quoted once in the New Testament, neither are Ezra and Nehemiah, by the way. Some scholars see Hebrews chapter 11, verse 34 as a reference to Ezra, where we're told that some of God's people escaped the edge of the sword. For centuries, we've understood that the absence of God's name in the book of Esther is one of the major points of the book. The point is this: even when God is invisible, God is involved. Even in the shadows, you discover that He is the shadow sovereign. Esther, in fact, has become one of the greatest revelations of the providence of God in Scripture, that God fulfills His purposes as He manages the events of world history. J. Vernon McGee used to say it this way, that providence is the hand of God in the glove of history. I like that. Now, I want you to think, as we begin today, I want you to think of Esther as the retelling of God's providence, sort of in the form of a play, a dramatic play. Maybe think of it as if you're attending a major musical production. I don't know about you, but my wife and I enjoy plays, and we don't see nearly as many as we'd like because of time, but maybe you've been to a play or a musical. One of the last ones my wife and I enjoyed was our daughter's senior play at Wake Christian Academy last year. Her senior year, Charity landed a role in the production, Little Orphan Annie, and of all the characters she could have played, my daughter played the rather unsanctified, sassy brazen young woman who, with her boyfriend, tried to get a hold of the ransom promise by claiming to be the long-lost parents of Annie. So the curtain rises, and my daughter comes out on stage in high heels and fishnet stockings, smacking her chewing gum and talking with a sassy New York accent. I had people come after me after and go, "Man, I never saw a charity like that before." And I said, "Me neither." Somebody said, "Wow, what great acting." I said, "I don't know." When she comes home, she's on restriction. That was a little too good for me. Well, maybe you've attended a play, and the usher handed you the playbill. And so while you're waiting, while the orchestra's tuning up, you're reading over the introduction. You're reading the bio of the actors and who they're playing. You read over the summary of each scene to get a feel for where this is going to happen and what's going to take place. And then the house lights dim and the curtain rises. As the curtain rises in Esther chapter 1, you're immediately struck, as you would be at a play, with the setting. And what a setting is given to us here. We'll just call this scene number one, and entitle it A Lavish Reception. Look at verse 3, where we left off. In the third year of his reign, this is Ahasuerus, the Greek king Xerxes. Remember, Ahasuerus is a throne name like Pharaoh or Caesar. He gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, all the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days. As a matter of fact, for 180 days. This is a six-month banquet. He had to have had a lot of money. He was rich. In fact, when Alexander the Great victoriously marches into Susa, he discovers more than 1,000 tons of gold bullion and 270 tons of gold coins. This was the pirate's chest trove. Ahasuerus had money to burn, and he's going to feed his guests. This is a sit-down dinner. This is 6 months long, and paying for this reception wasn't nearly as difficult for him as you paying for your daughter's wedding reception that lasted an hour or two, right? But I'm with you, dads. You've been there. I'm not there yet. But only the best for your daughters, right? Right? I happen to think that Smithfield's barbecue's the best, okay? So that's where we're headed. Well, that isn't on the menu here. In fact, you need to know that this is not some kind of extravagant banquet just to eat food. The third year of the reign of Ahasuerus corresponds historically to the great war council of 483 BC, held at the palace of Susa. It was at this council where the king met with the leaders of his vast empire to convince them that they could all successfully march upon and defeat the Grecian Empire. Greece and Persia are the two superpowers of this generation. And so this banquet is intended to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt to his subjects that he was everything he boasted he was, the king of all the earth, so one inscription read. So after 180 days of putting on the dog, so to speak, Xerxes now throws open the doors to include everybody else in the palace. Look at verse 5. When these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. That's a week. For all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa. That is the interior palace. From the greatest to the least. And it took place in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So all the administrative staff, his chief of staff, his family, his friends, they're all invited to this final climactic week 7 days where he rolls it all out. This is the finale. In fact, some of the details are given to us of his wealth and the luxury of this setting, this scene. Look at verse 6. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen, held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns. We've uncovered the fact that these columns came from Solomon's temple. He goes on to talk of couches of gold and silver. The Hebrew construction indicates these are not plated with gold or silver. These couches are solid gold and solid silver. Sitting out in the courtyard on this mosaic of precious gems that are listed here. And by the way, you ought to know that the Persian word for garden is paradida. The Greeks took that word, transliterated it for themselves, and it would be pronounced paradisus. We've taken that word from the Greeks and transliterated it and pronounce it paradise. The audience hall that has been excavated, where all the guests are eating, looks out over paradise. It's a magnificent garden where acres of ground featured cut stone channels for running water, where flowers were planted in beautiful geometric patterns, where trees also were planted according to creative and beautiful designs, where reflecting ponds added to the beauty of the gardens that framed at the king's palace. This was paradise. And if you had any doubt, Ahasuerus is the king of paradise. So this is the banquet of the century. And anybody who is anybody got an invitation. He has gathered all the dignitaries, the leaders, all the generals, all the admirals, all the powerfully connected movers and shakers in his kingdom, by the way, which stretches from Africa to India. If you were an outsider looking on, Ahasuerus seems every bit the undefeatable, powerful, commanding sovereign that could defeat Greece and any other empire on the planet. Certainly, he can command the greatest army the world has ever known. And then, with subtle irony, you discover that this great king cannot command his wife. So, as we leave the lavish reception of scene one, scene two opens with what we'll simply entitle a lascivious request. Would you notice the comment, by the way, first back in verse 9 that informs us that Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So somewhere else on that incredible palace grounds, she's holding a banquet. Now, the reception then of Xerxes would have been, according to the custom here, for men only. The women are being treated to their own banquet, more than likely the one covering just the 7 day period of time. Historians believe that she was giving this banquet for the household staff and also all of the wives of the king and his concubines. He had 360 of them. The word Vashti means desirable. There are some Hebrew scholars that believe it was a pet name. It was an honorary title for one of his favored wives. Jewish tradition holds that she was the great-granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the former kingdom of Babylon, defeated, by the way, by Ahasuerus' grandfather. Now watch what happens on the last day of all this feasting. Verse 10 informs us, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commands these seven eunuchs who serve him, verse 11, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. In other words, King Ahasuerus has shown off his splendor and his wealth and his power for 6 months and 7 days. He now decides to end this lavish reception with a rather lascivious request. He wants to show off one more of his prized possessions that he saved till last. And now we know from history that the Persian women were not required to cover their faces with veils. As the queen, one of the queens, perhaps the favored queen of the kingdom, she's already appeared in public, more than likely at some point in time during the 6 month reception, as well as other state functions. People have seen her. They would already have recognized the beautiful face of this favored wife. So what's going on? The Jewish Midrash, it's a commentary that goes all the way back to the second century, explains that the queen was being commanded to actually arrive unclothed, decorated only by the crown jewels. Now, I'm embarrassed to have to tell you that, what was actually going on. In fact, we're going to be embarrassed together a few times in the book of Esther as we take it at face value, but there's just no way to sanitize this. That's why verse 10, by the way, gives us the added insight. This happens, the king requests this when his heart was merry with wine. That's a long way of saying when the king was drunk. And we can be fairly confident that most, if not all of his guests were drunk along with him. This has been primarily a men's only banquet. The request comes, the king wants to end his banquet, not with fireworks, but with lust and envy. That's right, he wants his guests to envy him and regard him in only one more way as the man who has the world on a string. So they all envy him. Herodotus, the Greek historian who lived just a couple of decades after Ahasuerus dies, writes this about the Persian culture. He said it was so promiscuous that it was common for powerful and influential men to parade their wives and their concubines unclothed in order to show them off to one another to compete in this manner. You say, how wicked is that? Ladies and gentlemen, we're not very far away. This is Daytona Beach during spring break. This is Mardi Gras. This is tied up with the promise that whatever you see and do in Vegas stays there. This is the local gentleman's club where everyone but a gentleman will go. This is the billion-dollar pornography industry. This is the bachelor party you should have walked away from. This is the all-too-common story where women are paraded about and then tossed aside instead of being respected and loved by respectable, loving men. The spirit of Ahasuerus is alive and well, ladies and gentlemen. This isn't just for way back there in Persia. Frankly, you might expect Ahasuerus to demand what he just demanded. In this culture, this pagan heart of his, he was the king. He had 360 concubines and several wives to order around. You would expect that from this kind of man. He wants his guests to envy and admire everything about his life. And so he's selected this to be the grand finale. What you do not expect is verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. I love that. The main attraction. Here's the cue. She refuses to come out on stage. And everybody just sort of, you know, winds their watch. Not sure what's going to happen. All of a sudden, you have the supreme commander, you know, showing off for 6 months that he can command the empires of the world, and yet at this moment, he can't command his wife. Verse 12 continues, then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Now, pretend you're in the audience. There's a commotion backstage. You hear loud whispering, and everybody can hear the whispering. Something's going on. Something obviously wrong. And then the messenger who left to go out to bring the queen back, he comes back in without her. Can you imagine that messenger going over to the king and leaning down and whispering in his ear, she's not coming. His face turns red and then purple. He has been denied, but wait a second. I am the king of all the earth. I love this scene. The queen in the other room is saying, uh-uh. It ain't going to happen. Or however you say that in Persian, I don't know. But you're dreaming. She said, in a culture where you only say, yes, your majesty, she said, no. Alexander White, the 19th century Scottish pastor who wrote wonderful character studies of both Old and New Testament characters, said this of Queen Vashti. The sacred writer makes us respect the queen amid all her disgusting surroundings. The brave queen refused to obey the royal order. Her beauty was her own and her husband's. It was not for open show among hundreds of half-drunk men. Well said. We need to just stop and admire this woman. At this moment, she is displaying unusual character. She's standing up to a man who's known throughout history as being brutal. But she's also risking everything else, all the pomp and the glitz and the glamour and paradise. She's willing to walk away from paradise rather than become a sexual pawn for a little insecure man. She's willing to sacrifice her crown for the sake of her character. And we're going to be introduced next time to a woman who's willing to sacrifice her character in order to win the crown. So early on in this dramatic presentation, you're faced with the question, what's your character worth? Can you be bought? How far are you willing to go to win praise and be part of the crowd? Have you ever lost anything for doing something right? Maybe a passing grade. Maybe a sales contract. Maybe a relationship. Maybe a job. I want you to take heart from this dramatic presentation played out on the stage of history. It will cost Vashti everything. She will disappear from the annals of history. But back to the story, we've got a problem. The king he's got a big problem on his hands. He's supposedly able to command the greatest empire on the planet. He's supposedly able to command the greatest army on the face of the earth. He's just been slam dunked by his wife in front of all the dignitaries, in front of all the admirals and all the commanders and all the generals, all the leaders that he's been trying for 6 months to convince them to follow him into battle. Now, what he should have done is order a big pot of coffee and drink it all, sober up, and go apologize. But he doesn't do that. Scene two ends. Scene number three opens, and we'll call it a ludicrous reaction. Now, seven men come on stage. Verse 13 tells us these are the wise men who know the law and understand the times. We're told at the end of verse 14, these are the seven princes of the kingdom. They had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. These are his closest confidants. You see what's happening. He gets up. He excuses himself. And he leaves, and he's going to try to make it look like it's something to do with the law. The problem is we've got issues here that are legal. And so they get together with the seven counselors to figure out damage control. And I've got to tell you ahead of time, they come up with something that is absolutely foolish. In fact, it's even funny all at the same time. Let me take you to verse 16. This is the first thing they do here is they butter up the king's wounded ego. Notice the exaggeration. In the presence of the king and the other princes, Memucan, that's one of the seven wise men. He said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Man, this is worldwide. Now notice, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, well, hey, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. Never mind what he asked her to do. So verse 18, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. In other words, we're all in trouble with our wives. Our wives hear about this. Oh my, skillets will be flying, laundry piling up, dishes in the sink. We don't even want to go home. So we got to pass a law. Please pass an edict. Here's, pass it quickly. We got to stop this national disaster before it gets out. Here's their brilliant advice. Verse 19. Let a royal edict be issued. Let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media. It can't be revealed. That Vashti, notice he's dropped the word queen already. That Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus. Let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. Interesting. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all the kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. How many of you guys are thinking, this is a great idea. I like this book. Wow. The king even further clarifies the edict. Look at verse 22. That every man, here's the edict, that every man should be the master of his own house. Can I get a copy of this edict? Can you imagine some guy getting this in the mail? Oh man, this is what I've been needing. This is what I've been missing. Can you see him taping it up on the window by the kitchen sink and then one on the living room wall and then putting one on the dash of the minivan? And anytime the little wife disagrees, But what about, Memorize it, honey. This is crazy. How many of you guys are still saying, but let's give it a shot. What do you say? Yeah, I'll frame it. No. If you've been married longer than 2 days. you don't put verses up around the apartment. Submit. But no. Uh-oh. You don't legislate honor. You earn it. Thank you, sir. Just trying to win some points back there, aren't you? And all the men said, hey, all right, we're with you. You aren't treated with honor by your wife because you've got Ephesians 5 taped up. And you can't force respect. That stuff is sown and watered and fertilized and repeated over and over again if it's going to bear fruit. King wants respect from a woman he doesn't respect. He wants honor from a woman he has just dishonored. But he says, you know, I want to skip all that stuff. I don't want to water anything. I don't want to fertilize anything. I'm going to make it an edict. I want it now. And the edict of the king, by the way, only backfires. First of all, these seven guys in the king, they want to contain this embarrassing situation. But guess what? By sending out the edict via royal mail, the Pony Express, which they invented, the king does nothing more than publicize it throughout the kingdom. They're all afraid that all the women of the kingdom are going to stop obeying their husbands as soon as they hear about Vashti's disobedience, yet by sending out this royal edict, they actually ensure that every woman hears about it. These guys are really a first-class job. Bright. No wonder the Jews throughout the ages have howled with laughter at the foolishness of this king and these other insecure men who must still be under the influence of the king's wine. No, they've sobered up by now. But they are, and I want you to get this, they are under the influence of the King of Kings' will. God is moving history along. No matter how untimely or difficult the events of your life become, which are played out on the stage of your own experience, don't miss the very practical truth that's right now parading across a Persian stage, that God is backstage. In fact, he's written the script. His hand is in the glove of history, but listen, it's in the glove of your history, too. No matter how helpless you might feel as your own drama unfolds, God is managing every scene. He might be hidden in the shadows backstage. He might not have published a playbill that explains what the scene is all about. Don't you wish he did? But he didn't. But he's running the show. It's his show. One author writes, don't fall into the trap of thinking that God is asleep, even when it comes to nations, or that he's out of touch when it comes to carnal decisions, or that he sits in heaven wringing his hands when it comes to some godless ruler who makes rash or even foolish decisions. This is the wonder of God's providence, working behind the scenes, bringing out of even the most carnal and pagan, secular of settings, a decision that will set his perfect plan in place. You know what Esther chapter 1 is all about? Esther chapter 1 simply shows us how God arranges for a position to be opened up in the greatest kingdom on earth, a position that's going to be filled in just 16 verses by an orphan named Esther. A girl who will become a queen, who will influence the king in order to rescue the people of God. We'll introduce her next time. Maybe as we've been working through this drama, you know Jesus Christ personally, you're one of the sons or daughters of God the Father. Maybe you've been wrestling with the fact that the handbill is a whole lot shorter than you'd like. It's too brief. Doesn't provide enough information about the scene that maybe you're in right now. Will you trust this shadow sovereign? The Lord often gives us opportunities, in fact, more so, not of understanding, but trusting. So would you surrender afresh to the divine stage manager, the script writer, that you have been reminded all over again you can trust in whatever is happening, that it will ultimately fulfill his purposes, not only in history, but in his story for you. Thank you, Father, for that kind of confidence that we can glean from a terrible context where you might seem so far away. As you're talking to the Lord those of you that know him, if you're here and you don't know Jesus Christ, if we can take the Word of God where we can fully describe to you what the claims of Christ are. In the meantime, Father, thank you for the privilege we've had today. From the outset to now the conclusion, to glorify you, the King of Kings.